Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, October 24th, 2014. In Pennsylvania, a desperate governor does something unconstitutional and, frankly, unbelievable today. Desperate for re-election, Republican Governor Tom Corbett pulls out the new Willie Horton card, and in this case, the victim is Mumia Abu-Jamal. In an in-depth interview released to my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, Noelle Hanrahan of Prison Radio, who has for more than 20 years facilitated the public expression of Mumia Abu-Jamal, joins us, and you will hear Mumia's own voice denouncing the action today by Tom Corbett.
I think it's really quite extraordinary that unconstitutional Tom Corbett, a former attorney general of the state of Pennsylvania, as governor, would sign into law a law that he knows is unconstitutional.
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Moreover, as a governor and as an attorney, right, and a member of the bar, he had to take a sworn oath for both offices. And that oath was to protect and defend the constitutions of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and the Constitution of the United States of America. By signing that bill into law, he has violated both of his oaths as governor and as an attorney. As I said, he knows what the law is. He knows about Snyder versus Phelps. I'm sure you covered the case of the church that went around to funerals and, let's say, harassed people's families. They were burying their veterans, and they would have signs within earsight and eyesight of the families burying their dead. What went to the Supreme Court, because there was a similar law passed against them, and every court they went into found it a violation of the First Amendment, including the United States Supreme Court, which ruled 8-1 that the First Amendment free speech protection shielded these church members from tort liability for intentional infliction of emotional distress. This is something that I know unconstitutional Tom knows about.
In an act of sheer demagoguery, he signed into law the Victim Revictimization Act, or something like that it's called, and this is an unconstitutional attempt to strip the First Amendment rights away from Mumia Abu-Jamal, whose death sentence was converted to life without parole, and he's been in prison for more than 30 years, convicted of killing a cop in Philadelphia in 1981. And the irrational nature of this action is just astounding, and words fail me a little bit here, because we're told that the widow of Officer Faulkner, Maureen Faulkner, was distressed. Because recently, Mumia Abu-Jamal was asked and agreed to give a commencement speech to a small group, 20 students, at his alma mater, Goddard College, in Vermont. And by the way, in those comments, Mumia didn't reference his conviction, Officer Faulkner, or anything remotely related to that. And yet Governor Corbett says that Abu-Jamal and other prisoners have lost their rights when they go to prison. Now, Tom Corbett should know better. And if you listen to the in-depth interview, you'll hear the able arguments provided by Mumia himself, that Corbett, a lawyer, former attorney general, certainly knows that what he is doing is not legal. But it's a stunt for his election campaign, and he's down some 20 points against his Democratic challenger with just a couple of weeks to go. And so this move of desperation, which shreds the First Amendment, is truly outrageous. And there's an online petition that I'll link to in the show file for this podcast and the interview podcast, And I encourage you to add your signature. Click on it. And if you care to do more, I'd love to see that too. You can write a letter or leave a phone message for Tom Corbett in Pennsylvania. And, of course, you know, other ways on Facebook and other media outlets where you can make your voice heard. Meanwhile, demagoguery is the operative rule in Canada today. As you know, there were two attacks this week that were blamed on Islamist extremists. But from everything we know, and I've been skeptical about the initial reports, these were two misguided lone gunmen. The first guy didn't even use a gun. He ran over a couple of soldiers with his car. And the man in Ottawa, who's been identified as Michael Zahaf Bibeau, we're told was trying to get a passport so he could go to Syria and fight with the jihadists. Now, that's based on news accounts and comments from his mother. He apparently has been in Ottawa for several weeks and was staying at a rooming house where people overheard him angrily expressing his frustration because he couldn't get a passport. And interestingly, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police say that he wasn't one of some 93 individuals that they are on alert and monitoring carefully who they think might have similar plans. So keep in mind that everything we're hearing is coming from government sources. None of this has been pursued in a trial atmosphere where the facts are really tested. And yesterday, the Conservative Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, as I feared, went to the Parliament, and while on the one hand claiming that Canada is united in its response to these attacks, he went even further. And again, as I feared, he is using this situation, these two incidents, to promote his agenda, which is to make Canada into more of a police state. The Prime Minister told the House of Commons, "Our laws and police powers need to be strengthened in the area of surveillance, detention, and arrest. They need to be much strengthened. I assure members that work which is already underway will be expedited." So, this is the moment in Canada that's similar to the passage of the Patriot Act here in the United States in 2001. And to its enduring shame, the U.S. Congress barely read the Patriot Act, passed it, and now we live with the ugly elements, including the national security letters, these self-executed warrants that have been widely abused by the FBI, and the section of the Patriot Act that is used to justify the massive collection of phone records on millions of Americans every day. Now, what I find interesting is that despite the fact that Harper used terrorism or terrorist five times in his address, there is an opposition in Canada, and they're actually speaking up. Liberal leader Justin Trudeau described the Ottawa gunman as a criminal whose action should not be allowed to redefine the rule of law in Canada. "Criminals do not dictate how we act as a nation, how we govern, or the way we treat each other," he told the House of Commons. "They do not dictate our values. They will not make the rules about this land we share." And another member of Parliament Mulcair, said, he urged his colleagues not to allow hatred and violence to change our identity. He's the head of the NDP party. He said, "On Wednesday, we woke up in a country of love, diversity, and peace, and this has not changed. We cannot allow that openness and freedom to be rolled back." And then Justice Minister Peter McKay sounded the phrase that is used in the United States when they want to roll back our constitutional rights. They talk about the need for the right balance between security and civil liberties. And just a week ago, I heard former CIA boss and Pentagon chief Leon Panetta earnestly using those same phrases and telling us that we don't need to sacrifice our liberties for security. But he's been a part of the spy agencies that have carved out big gaps in our constitutional rights over the last dozen years. Now it's happening in Canada. It happened in Australia. And we will never recover the rights that are taken away from us. I'd love to be wrong about that, but I do not see any way in the foreseeable future in this country that we're going to have a serious effort to restore the full Fourth Amendment, restore the full First Amendment, even to Mumia Abu-Jamal. And the rationalizations that are used to justify these measures are all very carefully modulated. They're striking that balance, right? Well, this is where you can call me an extremist. I believe very strongly in the Bill of Rights. I don't believe we should compromise a single piece of it. And even though I don't agree with the way many people interpret the Second Amendment, I do respect people who are absolutist about it, because I'm absolutist about the other elements of our Bill of Rights. Now, I hope that by now you've had a chance to listen to our in-depth interview with Professor Lance DeHaven Smith of Florida State University. It was a few weeks ago. He published the book last year called Conspiracy Theory in America. And this is important to me because I'm one of those people who is skeptical of official government narratives of state crimes or potential state crimes. And as you know, I don't believe the official story about 9/11. And so it's fascinating that psychologists at the University of Kent in England published a study last year where they took a look at conspiracy theorists and their opponents. The report is titled, What About Building 7? A Social Psychological Study of Online Discussion of 9/11 Conspiracy Theories. Now, first I have to tell you that while I think this report is interesting, it's based on a very narrow sample of people who certainly are not representative of the broader communities of both conspiracy theory embracers and rejectors. It's based on people who go online and comment on news articles. And if you've ever dived in to the muck of online commentary, it's one of the reasons why we turned off the comments at peterbcollins.com. Most of the ones that came in were spam, but it requires me to moderate the comments, and a lot of them are either useless or just flamethrowers. And what happens often in these comment sections is that one person will post a sincere remark, and then the trolls come out. And they basically, will go off on various digressions where they talk to one another. And these are clearly people who have too much time on their hands. So my point is that this is not a representative sample, but it's still interesting. And what it showed is they reviewed 2,174 comments and found that many of the people who embrace the official government theories are generally more hostile when trying to persuade their rivals. And what the report concludes, and I think it's a stretch, but I like the conclusion, is that those of us who are willing to explore so-called conspiracy theories and willing to put up with being marginalized and tagged as conspiracy theorists are considered more sane than the people who buy the official story. Now, this certainly appeals to my bias. There's no question about that. But I recommend that you listen to the interview with DeHaven Smith, Because in his book, he shows that this phrase conspiracy theorist used to put people down originated with the CIA as it was trying to quiet the critics of the Warren Commission's bogus report about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And this article, which I picked up from an online outlet that I'd never heard of before called themindunleashed.org, and it's written by a person I've never heard of named J.D. Hayes, H-E-Y-E-S, who is linked to naturalnews.com. Well, the quote of Lance DeHaven Smith is, "The CIA's campaign to popularize the term conspiracy theory and make conspiracy belief a target of ridicule and hostility must be credited, unfortunately, with being one of the most successful propaganda initiatives of all time." The other thing that's really interesting is that the author of this article chose to embed a 5-minute video from my friend and colleague James Corbett. And maybe you've seen Corbett's send-up of the 9/11 official story. It's a brilliant piece, less than 5 minutes. And I'll tell you what, I'll link to that in the show file for this podcast too, so that you can review it if you haven't seen it already. So I find it interesting that at least some people are willing to go beyond this intellectual third rail of being called a conspiracy theorist and explore what that means and what type of people. Even if it's limited to a sample of online commenters, embrace or reject those theories. Over the past week, we have reported to you on a number of news accounts of conflicts of interest by people who worked at or continue to work at the National Security Agency. And one of the items related to former Chief Keith Alexander. General Alexander was head of the NSA and the Cyber Command until he retired in March of this year. He immediately formed Iron Net Cybersecurity Incorporated and started demanding $1 million or $600,000 retainers from clients who want his security expertise. And in a controversy that is dying down now, that erupted about a week ago, we learned that Alexander had executed a contract with the guy who continues to be the chief technical officer at NSA, Patrick Dowd. And the deal was that Dowd could work up to 20 hours a week, half-time, for Alexander's IronNet cybersecurity. And you say, what? A full-time guy at the NSA can also do a half-time job for a private company owned by the former head of the agency? This is another ugly example of the revolving door of agency officials and contracting companies. So, Reuters broke the story, and after a couple of days, Keith Alexander recognized that he had a stinky situation on his hand and announced a couple of days ago that the contract with Patrick Dowd has been terminated. But I credit Connor Friedersdorf, a good, aggressive, scrappy investigator who writes at The Atlantic. Yesterday, he published a lengthy article called "Where is the Investigation into Financial Corruption at the NSA?" He recounts what I just told you about Keith Alexander. He adds to it the work of Jason Leopold in forcing the NSA to release the financial disclosure statements, at least, of Mr. Alexander, General Alexander. He recaps, Friedersdorf does, the story we told you about Teresa Shea and her husband. Shea is the head of signals intelligence at NSA and has several troubling side businesses, and her husband works for a major signals intelligent contracting firm. And Friedersdorf also draws in Bill Binney, who's been on our program several times, the NSA whistleblower, who has told us that corruption of this sort was one of the reasons he left the NSA way back in 2001 and became a whistleblower. And I join Connor Friedersdorf in calling for real investigations of the apparent corruption at NSA. And last week we told you that we have corroboration of this from Russell Tice, another NSA whistleblower. Every day I like to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Show with your subscriptions. People like Gary Batterson, who kicks in $20 a month. He doesn't have to, but he chooses to. John Dickerson doubles up to $10 a month. Jason Ferguson is a regular subscriber. And our buddy Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, who I know is not a millionaire, kicked in $10. He saw I was trying to buy a promoted post on Facebook recently, and it upset him that he decided to help pay for it. And Facebook rejected my effort to promote my post anyway. And Carl is always the first to click like when I post an alert about a new podcast on Facebook every day. So thank you one and all for your support. I invite everyone else who's listening who's not a subscriber, if you got a little money in the bank and you like what we do here, please support us. PeterBCollins.com. Click the sign up link under my picture. $5, $10, $20 a month. Our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers earn the bonus CD from John Dist called Red Flag. Well, this is a good news, bad news situation. The bad news is that we have some dozen or more suspects who have been held by the United States illegally at the Parwan prison, which is part of the Bagram Air Force Base complex outside Kabul, Afghanistan. And while Obama has tried to close Guantanamo, and I think he's sincere in that effort, he has maintained this prison is a black hole. We have been blocked from finding out who has been held there. They have not been permitted to consult lawyers or even, in most cases, the International Red Cross. And now we've learned the identity of one of those people who's been held in the black hole at Parwan, a former Russian soldier who switched sides during the Soviet war in Afghanistan, stayed behind, and later fought American troops, is being flown to the United States, where he will face terrorism charges in federal court. His name is Irek Hamidullin. He's been held at the Bagram prison since 2009, and he's being brought here because our agreement with the Afghan government is that we will relinquish control of it at the end of this year, even though we're keeping almost 10,000 troops there indefinitely. Now, it's interesting because American officials have said that Hamidullin is not believed to be a major terrorist. They say he's one of several former Soviet soldiers who defected, converted to Islam, took up arms with the Mujahideen. And so to claim that with all of that history, that he was somehow part of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban is really pretty bizarre. But the good news is that they didn't send him to Guantanamo, and they're going to try him in federal court, not in one of the kangaroo court military tribunals that are inching along at Gitmo. We'll see where this one goes. The U.S. government, kind of echoing what New York Times columnist Tom Friedman used to feed us during the Bush administration years, which is 6 more months. Yeah, in 6 more months, Iraq's going to be stable. In 6 more months, 6 more months. He kept saying that. Well, now the government is trying to pacify the American people and say, look, it's going to take several months for us to retrain the Iraqi military so it can confront the Islamic State. And this is just more bullshit. The Iraqi army is comprised of mostly Sunnis who probably, you know, have bloodthirsty reasons for wanting to take on the Islamic State, the radical Sunni fighters. But they have folded, melted away, run for the hills when confronted by these aggressive Sunni fighters. And just as the crazy plan for us to train fighters in Syria, the so-called moderate rebels, now we're being told that we're going to train them to defend themselves. And how will that advance our stated goal of essentially wiping out the Islamic State forces? It doesn't make any sense. And I don't care how long you give the Iraqis to spend our money and be trained under our advisors. The country has already been divided. It's partitioned. And the idea that the Shiite fighters, the Shiite-dominated military and police force, will ever be prepared to wage the kind of combat that is needed if the U.S. is going to achieve its goals without American forces coming back to Iraq and being introduced into Syria, it just doesn't add up. And yesterday, I conducted an hour-long interview with Reese Ehrlich about his new book called Inside Syria. We did it at the Community Media Center. There'll be a video of it, and I'll have the audio for you here next week. But likewise, Reese Ehrlich does not believe in the myth of moderate Syrians or that the Iraqi military will someday soon be ready to take on the fight. And it just underscores the idiocy of what Obama has agreed to do here. In Hong Kong, the protesters have a new gambit. On Sunday, they're planning to hold a spot referendum and ask their fellow citizens whether the protesters should stay in the streets or accept government offers for more talks and clear out of the protest camps. I think this is very interesting. The three main groups, which are students, Occupy, and I'm not sure who the third is, have said on Thursday they would register public opinion at the main downtown protest site where thousands remain camped out. Now, you may recall, I think it was in May or June, that the Occupy group conducted a mock referendum on the regulations for future elections in Hong Kong. And I think they got hundreds of thousands of people to participate and overwhelmingly supported democratic rights. So I think this is a very interesting move. Hong Kong officials have said they'll hold regular dialogue with protesters about democratic reforms if they end the month-long demonstrations. But of course, dialogue is different from negotiation. And the chief executive, as he's known in Hong Kong, CY Lung, has made it clear that he doesn't have any latitude from Beijing to negotiate with the protesters. So the bottom line is, will they accept this meaningless gesture of dialogue, or will they continue to protest? And asking the people, I think, is a very interesting move on their part. Now, the news of Ebola, which I don't cover here because it's oversaturated in the corporate media, and I don't want to contribute to the hysteria, but Ebola, IS, Khorasan, the whole new U.S. military action in the Middle East has driven from the front pages and the TV screens the negotiations with Iran over its nuclear programs. And today, David Sanger of the New York Times writes from Washington that the strategy of the Obama administration is to conclude a deal with Iran, and the new deadline is for around Thanksgiving. But they do not plan to allow Congress to vote on it. And I think this is a necessary move, and I don't like to see this expansive use of presidential power as it's reflected in drone strikes and his unilateral decision to enter this war in Syria. These things should be conducted with the consent of the Congress. That's how our Constitution is written. But in this case, because the agreement with Iran essentially involves the president using his authority to reduce or eliminate sanctions, and because the deal with Iran is not a treaty that requires approval of two-thirds of the Senate, I think the White House is correct in this call. And Sanger writes, even while negotiators argue over the number of centrifuges Iran would be allowed to spin and other issues, we have seen that the president, the Treasury Department, in a detailed study, have concluded that Obama has the authority to suspend the vast majority of the sanctions without seeking a vote by Congress. And we've got even members of the Democratic Party, the president's own party, like slimy Bob Menendez, senator from New Jersey, basically threatens if a potential deal does not substantially and effectively dismantle Iran's illicit nuclear weapons program, I expect Congress will respond. An agreement cannot allow Iran to be a threshold nuclear state. Well, he's simply using the talking points of the State of Israel there. And I am hopeful this could be one of the few foreign policy victories and advances for Obama and his beleaguered, long-winded Secretary of State, John Kerry. And I, for one, would like to see regularization of our relations with Iran. Here in the Bay Area, tanker trains laden with tar sands shale oil extracted in North Dakota and Canada on the Bakken shale formation may start rolling into California and right here into the San Francisco Bay Area. There's a large refinery located along Suisun Bay in the little town of Benicia, which is just east of San Francisco. It's called Valero, and they are dangling the prospect of spending something like $70 million to construct a new terminal if they can get permission to bring this crudest of crude oils into the Benicia refinery. And to do so, they need to run tanker cars. They're projecting as many as 100 tanker cars a day, what some people refer to as bomb trains. And these tankers would roll through the capital city of Sacramento, the university town of Davis, then through Fairfield, and on over to the Bayside refinery in Benicia. And, of course, this is something that is producing understandable alarm by the people who live along the route. The San Francisco Chronicle quotes a man named Ed Russell, or, yeah, that's his name, who lives on a piece of property that the rail line comes directly through. And he's very concerned about the event in 2013 in Quebec, where 47 people were killed by the derailment of a 72-car tanker train. And I'm glad to see that not only people are pushing back, but the media is covering this issue. And I hope that cooler minds prevail, particularly with the glut of oil on the world market. We don't need to be bringing tar sands crude. It is much more dangerous when it's transported on these tanker cars. And time and again, we have seen derailments and explosions that are spectacular and deadly. And finally today, for old geezers like me, we remember not so fondly the presidency of Ronald and Nancy Reagan. Reagan was clearly starting to lose it to Alzheimer's even before he left the White House. But one of the craziest things that occurred while he served two terms there is that he and his wife regularly consulted with an astrologist based in San Francisco named Joan Quigley. And it wasn't just about what Nancy should wear or, you know, trivial matters. Reagan would use Nancy to talk to Joan and say, you know, what's the best day to negotiate with Gorbachev, the Soviet leader at that time? And it's really scary to think that the hocus-pocus of astrology, and I'm sorry if I offend you, if you think astrology is real and valuable, good for you. But I believe it's bullshit. And it's frightening that Ronald Reagan was running this country based on advice from this wacky reader of the stars and charts and tarot cards, a socialite named Joan Quigley here in San Francisco. And I don't know if she managed to predict it, but Joan Quigley died yesterday at the age of 87. Happy trails to you, Joan. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. Will you share it? I hope so. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until